All right, Hamilton, how about you ask me questions, I'll answer them, and we'll go from there.
So this interview took place many years ago while I was filming the pilot for my show. It's an interview with an infamous narcotics agent named Frank Liga. And Frank Liga's story could have warranted an entirely separate interview. He spent years undercover and was embroiled in a fatal shooting of another undercover police officer. So this is a classic example of the sort of muckiness of trying to pretend that you're a criminal. The two of them didn't know that they were undercover cops, and he fatally shot another police officer. If you want to read about that, look into it independently. I think it's beyond the scope of this discussion, which was actually about the chemistry of PCP. And I think that conversations like this are extremely valuable. It's important in general to talk with people who you disagree with, not to convince them to understand your perspective necessarily or to try to change their mind, but to understand why they believe what they believe. And I think in this interview, you can learn about the limitations of his knowledge, the misconceptions that he has, and how he feels comfortable spending his life locking up people who are synthesizing this molecule that he's never tried. If I had to go through the interview statement by statement and point out everything that I disagreed with, it would be longer than the interview itself. But I do want to point out a couple of inaccuracies that I think are worthy of dissection. And also, in general, I think you should just, you know, be aware in interviews that sometimes people say things that are untrue. So it's always good to be alert and to critically analyze what is being said. His claim about diethyl ether, 1 gallon being as explosive as 6 sticks of dynamite. I often hear the explosiveness of ether compared to dynamite, and I've had a lot of difficulty finding a scientific source for that claim. There is an EPA alert from 1994 that said 8 ounces of ether with peroxides has the potential explosive force of 1 stick of dynamite. And if you're using that math, then a gallon would be even more explosive than Frank Liga said. It would be 16 sticks of dynamite. But that just seems totally impossible to me, even just not really knowing all that much about how explosive 1 stick of dynamite is. The idea that 1 gallon is as explosive as 16 sticks of dynamite, there's no way. So I don't know where these numbers come from. Frank Liga says 6 sticks of dynamite. That also strikes me as an enormous exaggeration. Maybe if every ether molecule had formed a peroxide, something like that is conceivable, but I would be curious if anyone listening to this has any sort of quantitative data that addresses those issues. The other misconception that I think is worth introducing is the idea that PCP was first synthesized in the 1920s. Can't blame Frank Liga for saying that. It's actually repeated in the scientific literature occasionally, and the source of it is that people are confusing PCC, the starting material, and PCP. PCC was first synthesized in 1926. PCP was first synthesized 30 years later in 1956, but it's actually a pretty common mistake. And the final thing is just a funny anecdote. I used to work with a DP who had debilitating Crohn's disease, and he felt that smoking cannabis really helped him. So he was just stoned. He also just liked to be stoned. So he was stoned all the time. Everywhere we went, everywhere we traveled, everywhere we filmed, he was always extremely, extremely stoned. And I was walking into the police station where this interview was conducted, and I get this intense smell of weed, just overwhelmed by the scent of dank nugs. And I looked at him and I thought, are you kidding me? Are you serious? In this LAPD station, while we're interviewing a narcotics expert, you're going to bring weed into the station. How foolish are you? And I gave him this look, and he kind of understood and shook his head like, no, it's not what you think. And then I realized that this dank odor was not coming from the DP, but was actually coming from the police station itself, which was completely filled with cannabis. So I don't need to belabor the point that there is a lot of funny overlap between narcotics officers and the narcotics users that they are employed to arrest, but I think that it will come across to some extent in this discussion, and I hope you enjoy it. This podcast is brought to you by Sheath, a state-of-the-art undergarment. Tailored from spandex and modal, Sheath features a patented dual-pouch design for genital compartmentalization. The primary pouch cradles the scrotal sac, providing light testicular support and segregating the scrotum from the thighs and perineum, as well as the penis head and shaft, which are isolated in a secondary pouch featuring a micturition aperture. The separation of thighs, testicles, and penis shaft limits skin-to-skin contact, keeping those wearing Sheath dual-pouch underwear less vulnerable to chafing and soothed by cooling airflow throughout the anogenital region. The secondary penis shaft enclosure can also accommodate other items for a natural look that is both aesthetically pleasing and discreet. Thank you, Sheath, for your sponsorship. Use the promo code Hamilton for 20% off Sheath underwear technology. PCP, what I find so fascinating, is that it's real organic synthesis. You're not working with things that you bought at CVS. Well, you're working with real chemicals.
That's you as a chemistry background. The average person that manufactures PCP is third and fourth generation down the line, and they get a recipe. And 9 out of 10 times, the recipe is they go with their dad or their big brother and help them manufacture whatever stage they're manufacturing, and it's instilled them. And then when they get big enough to do it, because it's so lucrative, they do it. The thing we're seeing right now, and you're going to see it in your journalism, is that, like I said earlier, 90% or over 90% of the PCP that's manufactured is manufactured right here in Southern California. South LA, Compton, North Long Beach. That's 90% of the PCP is done in those three areas. And I'm not blaming those three areas or stereotyping those three areas. That just happens to be where these kids grew up.
Right.
Stage two and stage three, and you're being a chemist, you know there's three stages to manufacturing PCP.
Yes.
Stage three, and sometimes stage two, depending on if they buy commercial Grignard, which they can do,
yeah,
or they manufacture it themselves, is done remotely out in the Antelope Valley, out in the high desert someplace, because of the large volumes of the diethyl ether they're using. And for anybody who's ever been around ether, it's a sweet, pungent smell. Once you smell it, you'll never forget it, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And the moral to that story is, a lot of people, when I teach classes on PCP, a lot of people have never smelled ether. All the cars nowadays have electronic ignitions. You don't have the old hot rods where they're pouring ether in the carburetor to start the car. They don't have the starter fluid. They don't play with brake fluid that have diethyl ether in it. So they don't know what ether smells like. So what I tell my students, and my students being law enforcement, fire personnel, first responders, in today's world, if you're in the cities and you smell ether, you're smelling PCP. Make a phone call. Right, and obviously, you know the dangers with ether. The UEL-LEL, right?
What is that?
Upper explosive level or lower explosive level?
I know that it's explosive.
All right, the lower explosive level for diethyl ether is 1.36%. So say we're in a confined space. We're in a room, a garage, a shed, some kind of a confined space. You've got diethyl ether or anhydrous ether. The difference between anhydrous is it's without water. Moisture will ignite it.
Yeah.
All right. But diethyl ether, the lower explosive level is 1.36%. The upper explosive level is 36%. So anywhere between 1.36 and 36, that's volatile to explode.
Yeah.
Any ignition source will set that off. Yeah, right?
I'm sure.
Any ignition source. And ether explodes at a rate of 1 stick of dynamite, or 6 sticks of dynamite per 1 gallon of ether. 1 gallon of ether will make a hole the same as 6 sticks of dynamite. And you're looking at 1.36, 36. Right?
Yeah.
Take a match and throw a match in a can of gasoline. What happens?
It burns. It goes out.
Right. Why would it go out? Have you ever done that?
I have not thrown a match into a
can of
gasoline.
put a match into a gallon of gasoline.
Yeah.
It goes out like you threw it in the water.
Oh, because it has lower vapor density?
Because of the UEL helium.
Yeah.
You're either exceeding it, you're under the UEL helium at that point. So if you're throwing a match here and you're in a confined space and the vapors come up, now you're going to be within that range.
Yeah.
And now it'll ignite.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you throw it in, it goes out.
Okay.
And these guys, I've talked to individuals that have cooked PCP and been involved in explosions. I've had, over the years, I've found the way I identify the body is at the morgue. They got a John Doe at the morgue. And over a course of investigation, somebody says, oh yeah, so-and-so blew himself up. And I go over to the morgue, and sure enough, there's a body in the morgue that was on fire. A lot of times, they'll take them from the lab site, the family members, the girlfriends, because they'll call them, whatever, they're burning on the side of the road, out in the desert. Family will show up, grab them, throw them in the car, take them to the county hospital over here, UNC-MC, and throw them out in front of the emergency room and drive away because they don't want to get in trouble.
Right.
And the body of the person dies, and he's a John Doe, and we end up tracking him and finding him later. But I've had a guy tell me they were at a lab site, he and his uncle were at a lab site cooking PCP. The uncle went down to get Ethan. The criminal or the individual's in this shack, this makeshift shack, and he sees his uncle walking up the trail carrying 10 gallons of ether, 2 5-gallon cans. As his uncle's walking up, behind him is a blue fire trail following him. Right?
Okay.
Remember the old cartoons where the roadrunner, coyote will light something up and you'll see the trail go and it goes to the source and blows up?
Yeah.
That's what was happening. Ether is heavier than air as butane is. So when ether is released, it drops down and floats about 6 inches off the ground and creates a little puddle. And the more the volume that gets in there, it'll start moving with the wind.
Yeah.
And it'll continue, it'll bond and stay together until something breaks it up or it ignites. In this particular case, the guy's walking up the trail carrying 10 gallons of ether, and he's got a fire because there was a leak and it ignited at the car. Fire is following the trail up to him. And the guy, I said, what'd you do? He said, well, I pounded on the glass yelling for him. Then I said, well, what happened? I don't know. He says, he blew up. He said, I got the hell out of there. He says, I wasn't going to get involved with that. And he ran away. The guy blew up.
Oh, man.
And that's just this, you know, that's, you're talking you have to be a chemist to manufacture PCP. Even though it is tricky, these guys, it's inbred in handed down over generations to these individuals. And some of them know only one way to do it.
Right.
They'll do it one way, the way they were taught, and that's it. They won't go anywhere. They don't know how to deviate from it. Actually, they got it set up for some of the photos.
Is this all one lab in this series?
No. No, it's a compilation of different lab sites and different items. See, the top one on the left, I don't know what that is. It looks like a street view for a dump site. I can't tell. The next two are definitely a dump site. Now, I think they were in Compton, but just on the side of the road. What's unique with these manufacturers as well, and why, I don't know, and maybe after this segment, they won't do it anymore. But for whatever reason, PCP dumps are notorious for using up black plastic trash bags. It's almost a probable cause for law enforcement. If you see a 5-gallon can wrapped in black plastic trash bag, you have probable cause. If you ever took my class, you have probable cause to detain and conduct an investigation for possible manufacturing. Why they use black plastic trash bags for everything, I got no clue, but they do. Okay, this is a dump site in Compton. They did the large cook, packaged the waste up, put it in a truck or multiple cars, middle of the night, dropped it off on the side of the road, and away they went. This happens all the time.
And do you find the people associated, or this is just...
A lot of times we do. A lot of times we don't. But that's what's one thing unique with this team. Group 12 from LA Impact has the capability and the knowledge and expertise to go through that trash, that waste product, and try to go backwards, identify the chemicals, where they came from, identify who bought them, or maybe the trash cans or buckets or whatever, and identify the individuals involved. We have done that. It's a lot of work. It's a lot hard to do, but we have done it in the past, and they'll do it in the future. That's just another shot. And again, like I was saying, black trash bags wrapped around 5-gallon cans. Look at that first can in the left, very first photograph. You have to be a moron not to recognize that as a 33-gallon plastic trash can wrapped in black plastic. Right?
And they like that? That's their...
That's the way they package them up when they move them. Lab waste. That's an actual PMB, phenylmagnesium bromide cook. Ether can. The funny thing about these things is we don't know what they put in them. They open them, they use the ether, and then they sometimes refill the cans. A lot of times we don't know what's going in it.
Right.
I don't know if he has a picture of this or not, but we did a case a few years back where the fire department search warrant officers found a detached garage. It had 23 5-gallon cans labeled diethyl ether, had two 55-gallon drums labeled industrial wax, and a bunch of other crap. The 5-gallon cans were bulging top and bottom. But as a chemist, what's that tell you?
They've been refilled.
Well, they've been refilled. They're under pressure. Ether, for one thing, is what? It expands under pressure.
Yes.
Right? So the cans are definitely expanding. They're labeled diethyl ether. Is diethyl ether in them? We don't know. I know that diethyl ether and phenyl magnesium bromide are precursors to PCP labs. Based on training experience, a detached garage in South LA should not have 23 5-gallon cans labeled diethyl ether and two 55-gallon drums with industrial wax rated on them, right?
Yeah.
So you might suspect that there'd be possibly PMV involved, right? PMB being a water reactive explosive chemical.
Of course, yeah.
Right. Well, the fire department, not knowing what they had, saw the cans expanding and wanted to spray them down with water. Think that would be a good idea?
It's a bad idea.
Bad idea. One of our guys approached the fire captain, their commander.
Was that the idea?
Yeah, it was the idea. Approached the commander of the fire battalion and said, "Hey, that, you know, this is probably a PCP lab and we'll handle it. Let's relax. It's getting dark. We'll take care of it." They continued on. And the guy goes, "Oh, all right, maybe we can't. We don't want to put water on it. So let's get the robot." So they were going to get the bomb squad robot and pick a can up and take it out to the street one at a time. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
If it produces sparks, it might be a
bad
idea.
Can is already under pressure because it's bulging, clearly bulging on top and bottom.
Yeah.
Bad idea. What ended up happening, and that the fire battalion chief wouldn't listen to our guys, but what ended up happening is they had firefighters, carry the cans out two at a time, put them in the street. And then they determined that it was secured and handed over to our team. Our team processed it. The cans contained diethyl ether, PMB. The two 55-gallon drums contained PMB, phenyl magnesium bromide, right? At a rate of 6 sticks of dynamite per 1 gallon of ether, we had 23 5-gallon cans plus 110 gallons of anhydrous ether. What kind of a hole do you think that would have placed in the city if they squirted it with water?
Been a big one.
It would have been a big one. That's part of the dangers associated with manufacturing PCP.
So what did you do? How do you deal with it?
We let it cool down. We pulled it out, processed it, pulled a random 1-ounce sample, photographed everything, called the state of California Department of Toxic Substance Control. And they came and carried it away and sent it to a disposal. But we only take a 1-ounce sample. In situations like this, we photograph the totality, and we take a random 1-ounce sample.
I see.
Otherwise, we don't need 25 samples of the same thing.
Right. And why do they even have phenyl magnesium bromide sitting around? Wouldn't they use it in the synthesis?
Not necessarily, because they're so hard to get. It's so hard to come by, so hard to get. In the organization for manufacturing PCP, especially today, everybody doesn't have the same control. Everybody doesn't have the ability to get all the chemicals. Say, I got you, you're my buddy, you're a chemist, you can get me some chemicals.
Okay.
All right. I get the chemicals. I give them to another guy over here who's got this location. he's got the spot to cook it. You don't, I'm not going to tell you where the spot is, because if you get caught, you're going to rat him out. The police might be able to turn you into an informant, and you'll know where the lab site is. We're not going to tell you where it is. You get one chemical, I get another chemical, this guy here gets the location, and whether I'm the cook or we got a designated cook, he does it. It's all big, big business. Then it's packaged, presented, and shipped east. 99% of it is shipped to the East Coast, planes, trains, and automobiles every single day.
I find that strange as well. We were speaking with a lot of PCP addicts in Philadelphia, and they not only did they have no idea what PCP really was on a chemical level, they thought it might be, embalming fluid or radiated
insect spray. Right, that's just a street name.
Right, but they had no idea. They didn't know anyone that had ever made it. They were so distanced from the manufacturing, it seemed odd. Why even bother transporting it across the country when just it would only take one person in Philadelphia?
Been asked that question for 20 years.
Yeah.
I say, it's controlled and manufactured and controlled in Southern California. And I've been accused of trying to hog PCP and take claim for, we're the best team in the world because we got all the PCP. It's got nothing to do with it. The reason I'm as smart as I am on manufacturing PCP is because I live in the hub of where PCP is produced and manufactured. And I took an interest upon it and chose to dedicate the last 20 years of my career into investigating and manufacturing PCP organizations. Nobody else does it. I get called all over the country all the time to testify in court as an expert and or to help identify chemicals or to write search warrants for such chemicals.
Right.
But like you said, why don't they do it over there? Got no idea. A few years ago, I had a criminal that I identified that had ordered some chemicals. Ordered up a 55-gallon drum of phenylmagnesium bromide from a company.
It's so lazy of them to not make it themselves.
Well, that's easy. They're afraid to make it, and it's easier to buy a 55-gallon drum to make it.
Yeah.
You're talking, it's a pain. Like you said, I'll show you pictures of actual PMB cook sites where the magnesium didn't cook off, and they had to take a strainer and throw it out. But in this particular case, I identified a location in Baltimore where it was going. So I called the DEA or Baltimore police out there, and I says, hey, I got a guy who's ordering chemicals being shipped to this location in Baltimore. I said, he's leaving LA right now in his SUV. He's probably going to drive to Baltimore, pick the chemicals up, and drive them back. Can you do a controlled delivery on that 55-gallon drum? And the guys kind of blew me off. They gave it 3 hours. And in fact, they called the DEA out there. DEA called my buddy out here that I worked with, and they wanted to know who that crazy local was trying to tell us how to do our job. About 3 days later, I get a phone call from Baltimore. A house blew up in Baltimore. They described what they had. They were setting crystals. They were doing a PCC cook in a basement of this house in Baltimore, and it blew up on them. And so the investigators, the U.S. attorney, the DEA investigator, and the Baltimore detective had photographs, and they called me up and wanted to know what I thought. And so I'm explaining to them what they had, and it looked like what they had, and they says, what are you doing Thursday? This was like a Monday. I says, nothing, why? We'll be out to see you. Okay. So they flew out here. Thursday morning, I gave them a class on manufacturing PCP. I looked at their photographs, told them what they had, and basically told them what to do next. They went back to Baltimore, set the case up. They were going to do an indictment, but the guy that was got the chemicals delivered originally was murdered. I know who ordered the murder. The guy out here ordered the murder on this guy. Can't prove it, have never proved it. But I got a phone call from the Baltimore detective on a Sunday, the following Sunday, telling him I don't need to come to Baltimore anymore because they killed their informant and the case is done. Again, why go out there? What was happening was the guy was to get around the precursor laws. The Los Angeles criminal ordered chemicals, shipped them to Baltimore, was going to drive across the country to Baltimore to pick them up and drive them back to California, believing that if they got stopped, no one would know what they had, which they wouldn't. And they'd label the can with, like I said, industrial strength wax remover or something. You know, in fact, we did a case not too long ago where the guy was doing the same thing. He went to Texas, picked up a load and a load of ether, and they ripped the labels off, and he put it industrial striper, meaning instead of stripper, they spelled stripping wrong, put striper. So it goes on.
It looks like they peel off the labels on some of these other ones.
They try to peel off labels on all of them because they know that we can track them back. It's very difficult for us to for us to do that. That's PCC sludge. You're familiar with the manufacturing of PCC. I'm not going to go into the how you actually manufacture PCC. And PCC is piperidinocyclohexanone carbonitrile. 26-letter word that's about this long. I don't know how to spell it. I don't know how to say it.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. And that is the precursor to PCP. You have to have PCC crystal to manufacture PCP.
This looks like some grimy PCC.
Nope, that's just the waste. That's called Black Death. That's just the byproduct, the waste.
So that's very high cyanide concentration?
Cyanide and the other chemicals that we're not going to mention. You're a chemist, you want to say it, knock yourself out, but I'm not going to.
I don't feel like
giving a chemistry class to possible manufacturers on your TV show.
Well, the internet's already that chemistry class.
Oh, absolutely. That's what we do. We pull all the items out of the container, put them out on plastic, go through every one, photograph every one. We label it, then we pull chemical samples, take a picture of the sample with the parent container, and the rest is all destroyed. Yeah, it's not that glamorous. There, we're through them.
Wow.
It's not that glamorous.
It's amazing, though.
It's amazing, but it's the same set of circumstances over and over and over again. It's trying to catch these guys, and the internet helps us, because sometimes these fools, and I say fool gingerly, but they'll create a fictitious company and put themselves as a CEO, and you pull their Facebook page up and they've got themselves with their big picture smiling that they're the CEO of a company, and we can sometimes track them that way. So it's fun. It's a lot of fun trying to find these guys and identify them and see who's who in the zoo and who does what and who's going to go where and where it goes.
Can we sit down and discuss this some more?
Yeah, absolutely. Have a seat.
You said that sometimes you'd approach a lab and you'd already know who was operating it before you'd arrested anyone. How are you tracking these people, and how do you get turned on to a lab before you've actually caught anyone in the act?
Well, there's various ways, thousands of ways, to start an investigation. Normally, it's by an accident. Talk to somebody, or you overhear something on a phone, or you get somebody arrested for something else who says something and gives you a clue, and you follow it and work it up. I happen to be in a case we're working now that I can't talk about. Well, I'm not working it because I'm retired. But the team is working it, and it's going to be a big case, a real, real productive, good case. And I stopped that by accident. I happened to be in an office one day, and a phone rang, and one of the detectives answered it. And his response was, "Pipe iodine." I don't know what the hell that is. I said, "Give me that phone." All right, pipe iodine is piperidine.
Yes.
Right, which is a precursor chemical to manufacture PCP. I said, "Give me the phone." And I talked to the guy on the other end of the phone. It was a sergeant from one of the gang units. They served a warrant, and they found a chemical receipt in the name of this individual for piperidine. So I took that and started working it up. And it led us from one point to another point to another point. And now that case specifically is a national case. I don't know how long it's going to take to do, but we've been working it a long time, and it's going to be a great case. And that was just a pure accident that I happened to be in the right place at the right time to overhear the mispronunciation of a word. Or over the years, I've developed contacts with chemical companies. And chemical company people, individuals that own chemical companies, they have a good idea of what's going on in the world. And I give them a list of chemicals and say, "Hey, if anybody comes down with this, asking for this stuff here, can you give me a call?" That gives me leads. patrol officers give me leads. What gave me a lot of leads is when I went out and taught classes. I teach in-service law enforcement personnel. I'd give them a four-hour class on clandestine laboratories, the chemicals and equipment used to manufacture, and the hazards and dangers associated with those chemicals. And this is to include all the manufacturing, not just PCP. Methamphetamine, GHB, MDMA, cocaine base, cocaine hydrochloride, anything manufacturing, I give this class on it to in-service law enforcement personnel. And for about a month after the class, we get calls like crazy because these people are out walking around working their normal job, and they'd see cans or containers or hear things and give us calls. That's how some of the ways we get clues. And as in this one individual with the largest seizure, once they start, they don't give up. It's too prosperous. It's too much money. It's too easy to do. And if you know what you're looking for, it's very easy to track them down and to start an investigation.
Do you think some of these chemists really love what they do and don't want to stop for that reason?
I don't know if they love what they do, but it's their lifestyle. This individual with the 130-gallon seizure, largest seizure, prior to taking him to jail, we're standing there talking, and he says to me, he goes, "Yo, Liga, you've been following me a long time, huh?" I says, "No." He says, "We just followed you a little bit, like last week." I says, "I followed you Friday by myself." He says, "I seen you." I says, "Yeah." He says, "Oh, you did. We went head-to-head. He saw me at a parking lot. I was parking in a..." But I used to have long hair, now I have bald. But I was parking in a space at a storage facility. He drove by me, we went face to face. He didn't recognize me. I hid in the back of my vehicle. When he came out carrying chemicals on a wagon and putting them in his truck, I took pictures of him. Then we tracked him to another place, followed him to another place. And then, so basically this investigation was only about, we started a month earlier from a clue in New York, and we got on this guy and we closed down the investigation with the largest seizure in history in about 4 days. And he couldn't believe it. "You've been following me for months, haven't you?" "No, I just started the other day." And when I said when he went back to prison, when he left, I wished him good luck, told him goodbye. It was nice chasing him. And he said basically the same thing to me. He said, "We were kind of like the coyote and the dog at punch out time. No hard feelings between either one of us. It was his job to do it, my job to catch him, and we did that, and now he's gone, and we moved on, and I retired."
Do you ever feel bad for these people, or think that maybe they're not bad people?
No, not at all. No. You don't have to be a bad person to do criminal activities. I mean, a lot of them are. But we in law enforcement, we got nothing personal. We don't care who does what or when they do it or why they do it. We follow the laws, at least this group here, the group that I worked. We follow the rules and the laws. We're assigned to do an to work clandestine laboratory and manufacturing of dangerous drugs. And that's what we did. Nothing personal, nothing on the side, no vendettas. I catch you, I catch you. If I don't catch you, I don't catch you. And the good thing about working this team, if I don't catch you today, I'll catch you tomorrow. Because you'll be doing it again. Once I identify you, you don't stop. It's whether or not I put the time and effort into working the case up and investigating it.
And just to take a step back to the 1970s, so this is a drug that, or even the 60s, this is a drug that first appeared on the street sometime in the mid to late 60s, I've read.
Well, the drug was initially produced in the 20s. It was manufactured and identified in the 20s. In 1957, the government got 64 human volunteers to do a test study for PCP, phencyclidine. It's a dissociative anesthetic. Separates the mind from the body. All right? They wanted it for trauma surgery. They wanted it for the war effort. From 63 to 67, Park Davis patented PCP under the trade name Cernal. All right?
Yep.
You know that word.
I do.
All right. In 67, they realized that Cernal was not a good drug. It was being covertly used to get high and out of control. Plus, the side effects were damaging, and they realized this is not for human consumption, and they produced many, they scheduled it as a Schedule II controlled substance. You're familiar with that ruling?
I am, yes.
Right. Park Davis didn't want to lose any revenue, so in 63, or 68 rather, at the end of 67, early 68, they repatented Cernal under the trade name Cernalin. And you're familiar with that name?
I am.
Right. Cernalin was used from 67, at late 67, to 78. When again, over that 10-year period, it was being diverted covertly for illegal substance abuse. But it was used widely in the veterinary world for animal control. That's why the majority of the street names that we come across PCP, with the exception of angel dust, has some sort of an animal attached to it. Monkey dust, elephant tranquilizer, who knows? Whatever they come up with. Names mean nothing. In the enforcement world, in law enforcement, names mean nothing. Because you as a group smoke a dope, smoke something, you decide, okay, I'm going to call this Generation P. Okay? Gen P. Now, I'm doing an investigation. I'm going, Gen P. I never heard of Gen P. So people are calling me, yeah, we got this Gen P. What's Gen P? I don't know. So I got to track Gen P down or find out the signs and symptoms of Gen P to determine that Gen P is actually PCP, phencyclidine, angel dust. It's just a different name, some different group of some different generation put on the same drug.
Right.
Right? And sometimes it throws us off, sometimes it don't. But it's the same substance, just with a different name.
Right. But do you think this is the first instances of abuse or non-medical use of PCP were associated with its use as an animal tranquilizer, that people were diverting the Cernalan and using...
Oh, between the first, from 63 to 67?
Yeah.
Absolutely. What they were doing, and how they were doing it, 63 to 67 was the heart of the Vietnam War, right? 67, they were starting to evacuate Vietnam, and I'm not a history puff, and I wasn't old enough to go to the Vietnam War. I missed it by about 2 years. But that was the heart of Vietnam, and they were trying to find something where they could, these medics could treat these people who are blown up, because the Viet Cong's motto, they didn't want to kill you, they wanted to disable you. Because instead of killing you, it took two guys or three guys to carry you out. So by knocking one guy out, I knocked four guys out.
Right.
So they needed some kind of a substance to do trauma surgery in combat positions. And PCP is perfect for that because it's a dissociative anesthetic. It separates the mind from the body. So you have no sense of feeling. You got no sense of pain. I can do whatever I want to do to you. You are functioning. You are awake. You are competent. But you are under the influence by this anesthetic where you don't feel anything. So I don't have to sedate you and knock you out and worry about that aspect of the surgery.
Right.
Right? I don't need to worry about your respiration. You're breathing. You're yelling at me. But you're not feeling any pain while I'm working on you. Because my job is to stabilize you, get you ready to go to transport. And PCP was perfect for that. In today's world, and then they're also using ketamine. Ketamine is an analog of PCP.
Yes.
Right? And ketamine is overused today. I'll bet somewhere today, within a mile from here, somebody's evaporating ketamine and snorting it up right now. Just another dissociative anesthetic analog of PCP. But while these guys, back to your question, while these guys in the 60s, were using it for legitimate use, Vietnam War was not a happy place. Not that I know because I wasn't there, but I've talked to a bunch of people that went and came back. And they did pretty much anything they could do to take their mind off the war. And here you got a drug that if you take it, it gets you high and you can still function and do different things. It was pretty popular. So yeah, it was abused pretty heavy over there. And that's probably why they knocked it out so quickly. But again, that's only my opinion. I have no fact to base that opinion on. But from 63 to 67, that was the heart of the Vietnam War era.
And then at some point, people stopped diverting it from medical or veterinary use and started manufacturing it in clandestine labs. Do you know when that transition took place, when the first clandestine PCP labs emerged in the U.S.?
No, but I can not off the top of my head, but I know it occurred here in South LA, and I know the family that did it, and I'm not going to name the family because the family's still alive and well and active, and they're like six generations in South LA. But there's one family in South LA that basically started the PCP epidemic in the 70s, and they are like the godfathers of PCP in South LA.
Very curious.
Not going to mention the names at all, but they're still active. There's family members that are running around, still involved. But it's moved on. It went from them to the gangs. The gangs control it. Black gang members control PCP. And the old gang wars from the 80s, the Bloods and the Crips, the blue and the red, doesn't apply to this level of criminal. Like we were talking outside, you have an app, you have a source of piperidine, I have a source for PMB. We're friends. You're a Crip, I'm a Blood. It's green now. We're making money.
Right.
And that's where it went to. We're making money. And that's where it is, still is today. Like I said, a gallon of PCP in LA goes for $12,000 to $17,000. That same gallon in the Midwest, in New York, Philadelphia, Maryland, goes for $35,000 to $65,000 for the same dope. The dose level is 1/20 of a milliliter, $10.20 a drop.
And this first family that brought, they were not gang members.
No, they were.
They were. Because someone at some point, you know, you're talking about how it's sort of an oral tradition and it's passed down. These people don't necessarily understand the chemistry, that they're just copying what the person before them did. But at some point, someone had to figure out this bucket method. They had to go to the original articles written by the chemist who discovered PCP, Vic Maddox, and they had to adapt his synthetic route for clandestine manufacture. So I'm curious about who that was. It was this family?
Well, I wasn't around in the
70s. Yeah.
But from what I'm told from my mentor, the guy that taught me PCP investigations, who retired... He retired 13 years ago. He was my mentor. I followed him around like a puppy and tried to learn anything I could. He told me about this group, and we arrested a couple family members of this group for it. I have some informants that are informing on these people that are in fear for their life right now, today, to this day, because they informed on these individuals. So if this is a fact or just a fairy tale that got started and sent around Southern California, the PCP world, I have no idea. That's why I'm not going to give you a name. I don't. Hansel and Gretel.
They're not the sorts of people that would want to talk to us on
camera. Oh, no, they wouldn't talk to you. But the moral to the story is, I don't know if it's fact or fiction. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's folklore, because you're talking 35, almost 40 years ago. And it's folklore amongst the PCP world, the active people in PCP. They don't really know. They just know what they were told.
Right.
But there's got to be a reason why PCP is started and finishes in Southern California. All the PCP in the country can be linked directly back to Southern California. And I don't know why. Because some of the rationale says, what about the Mexican cartels? They're violent. They'll kill you just as soon as look at you. And yet they manufacture methamphetamine all over the United States. Correct?
I guess so.
Sure, they do. Why black gang members control PCP and they control who manufactures it? They won't let just anybody go manufacture it.
Who does? I don't know.
I don't either. These black gang members that control PCP in Southern California control everything related to it. It's made by black people. In the 20 years, 17, 20 years I worked PCP, specifically worked PCP, I only came across two sites that were Hispanically run, and neither of those were manufacturing. They were chemical facilitators. They were buying the PCP from the gang members, and in turn selling it in their neighborhood. And their neighborhood is known for selling PCP. If somebody comes to LA, you want to get PCP, they'll tell you to go here. and the Hispanic gang members are selling it to you. But they buy it from black gang members in South LA. And only two occurrences, one up north and one down here, where Hispanic gang members were caught with chemicals for PCP, but they were just facilitating the chemicals. And your question is why? I don't know. You're saying it's widely used in the black community, but it's also widely used in the white community, the Hispanic community. It's just everybody uses it right across the board. If you look at local news, when you go back east, try to dig up local news, not national news, but local news from some of these small Midwest or small suburban communities, towns and villages around D.C., around Maryland, around Detroit, around Chicago, around Illinois. The local news is going to have your naked guy running down the street doing wild and crazy things, fighting with the cops. You know why? Because the PCP is going there. They're setting up shop. They're selling it to them. They don't know how to control the dose, and they're overdosing, and they're doing all this wild and bizarre stuff. You won't see that in Southern California. Very, very rarely do we see somebody run down the street naked, fighting, screaming, yelling anymore. You don't see it because the dose levels are so controlled. The term they use is two puffs, I'm good, three puffs, I'm whacked. And my team laughs at me when I say that. I got a bunch of people that use PCP on a daily basis that I talk to. I interviewed hundreds of people that I talked to over the years that smoke PCP. And the term two puffs, I'm good, three puffs, I'm whacked, which means two puffs, they're functioning addicts. They're under the influence. They've got all the signs and symptoms of being high. They've got the euphoria or whatever feeling they get for it, but they don't have the adverse effects.
Right.
Three puffs, they're whacked. Three puffs, they start hallucinating and they start doing the stupid things.
Right. One thing I find interesting about PCP is it's a drug that people seem especially afraid of. You know, if you're in the U.S. and you have to have drug education when you're in school, there's a big move to make you afraid of essentially all drugs.
And rightfully so.
But it doesn't last very long for most people.
No.
Maybe when you're in middle school, you think everything's bad. Then you go to college and you see people doing cocaine, maybe even heroin, smoking pot, all these different things. And you start to have a more liberal idea about drugs. Maybe, maybe not. But for many people, they do. But PCP is not one of those drugs. It's a drug that, you know, it terrifies almost everyone. There's very few people that will stand up for PCP. When we were working on this documentary, we looked long and hard to find a single person that would stand up for PCP and talk about, you know, its virtues.
Well, again, you're talking about what you said, people education.
Yeah.
People have been educated to believe that people under the influence of PCP are monsters, superhuman strength. They don't think, they don't see, they have the blank stare. Their bodies are on fire, right?
Yeah.
They feel no pain. They got the superhuman power. It's all easy explained. PCP is a cyclic drug. It mimics the signs and symptoms of a stimulant, a depressant, and a hallucinogen. Right?
Yeah.
And everybody is different. Everybody's different. And it's also fat soluble. Depending on the quality, depending on your tolerance level, It's not psychologically addicting, it's physically addicting. And these guys will smoke it, and it depends on what stage they're in. When I teach classes for law enforcement, especially in Southern California, I teach them to control and contain anybody under the influence of PCP. If you suspect they're under the influence to that extent where they're violent, they're naked, they're destroying things, they're charging you, they're doing all of the things that everybody thinks should happen when you're under the influence of PCP. The last thing I want are my officers to go in that scene and get hurt because, number one, they've got no sensation of pain. It's dissociative anesthetic. They're not feeling pain. They're superhuman strength because their adrenaline is overboard. Their body is flush with adrenaline. And they're either in a stimulant mode or they're in a hallucinogen mode or a combination of both. So they're seeing wild and crazy things, hearing wild and crazy things. They got no pain, and they're really super strong. The last thing I want are my officers to contact that individual and have to go hands-on with them, not so much for their safety, because the crooks are crooks. You're under the influence, you're doing that. What happens, happens. But for the officer's safety. And in today's world, everybody and their brother has a phone with a camera and video recorder on it. In today's world, the cops are the bad guys. And when you got some poor, innocent young man standing there and looking at blank stare or pulling his teeth out or punching through a block wall or a wooden fence or whatever he's doing stupid under the influence, and this cop goes up and starts fighting with this guy or starts hitting him with a baton or a taser or whatever, that doesn't look good for the police.
No.
Right? We may win eventually, or we may lose. This guy may come around and hurt us. We get enough people there. What I found over the years is that people under the influence of PCP at that level can be identified like a bunny rabbit. And you think that's a funny analogy, right? You take a bunny rabbit and you got a bunny rabbit in your front yard. And you go out there and the bunny rabbit is cornered in your front yard. What does that bunny rabbit do?
It runs.
Eventually, what it does is it freezes, right?
Freezes.
It'll stop.
I'm not experienced with
rabbits. A bunny, it'll stop. Okay. And it'll look for an escape route. It'll look to try to get around you. If it can't get around you, a bunny rabbit will try to get around you. But it'll look for that escape route. These guys under the influence will do the same thing. You want to keep the sensory stimulants down as well. You don't want to be one guy talk to them. You don't want to shine lights in their eyes and scream at them, because it riles them up. It works. It gets the blood pumping even faster than it is under the influence of PCP. And because it's a cyclic drug, they may go from a stimulant to the hallucinogen. What you're hoping for is eventually it'll rotate over to a depressant. That's one of the three it mimics. And when it goes into the depressant mode, you can see the body, literally see the body relax. The arms will go down, the shoulders will drop, the jaw muscles will drop, and they'll give you that blank stare. They'll look right through you, look a million miles away. You'll never know they're looking at you. At that point, you can walk up, put hands on, put them in a car, take them to the hospital. Handcuff them, put them in the hospital. At that point, get them to treatment. The if you recall the Michael Singletary case from April of 2002, Big Lurch. Ever hear of that case?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Well, Big Lurch was walking northbound on Figueroa at 111th to 108th Street. The radio call came out of a big woman dressed in a red dress walking up in the middle of the traffic. Big Lurch was 6'7", I think. Big, tall guy. And the radio call came out, a tall woman dressed in a red dress walking in traffic. The radio car arrived, and he was naked, covered in blood, walking in traffic. And they said he wasn't under the influence of PCP. That was part of the defense. He wasn't under the influence of PCP. But they called experts in and found out that PCP is a cyclic drug. And at the time the officers had approached him, he was in a depressant mode. Because the officer says, yeah, he didn't say much, but he was very cooperative. They handcuffed him, put him in a car, took him to jail. Right? Because he was in the depressant mode at the time.
And they thought he was a woman wearing a red dress because he was covered in blood.
That's what the radio call announced when he was when the citizens called the cops.
It's very strange.
You know what he did?
He ate his friend.
His girlfriend, his roommate.
Yeah.
He murdered his roommate. They found part of her lung tissue in his stomach and part of her cheek or tongue. I taught a class a couple of weeks ago to the medical examiner's office at their annual conference, and one of the doctors there was the trauma doctor when they brought him in, and she pumped his stomach, and she was really impressed with that case.
Wow, I've been pen pals with him for years.
Really?
Yeah.
He still denied that he did it? Doesn't remember?
He says he doesn't remember, yeah. Which seems possible. It seems I believe that he doesn't remember if he had that much PCP in his system.
Well, they said he smoked. I mean, again, I never don't know the guy, but they said he's, and I guess he admitted that he was smoking every day, heavy smoking every day. And you're talking, this was in 2002, April of 2002, this occurred.
Yeah. Now his family and even the family of the victim are suggesting that he did eat this friend, Tynesha, but that he may not have killed her, and maybe it was her boyfriend that...
I never heard of that. I'm not going to get in debt, but that's they can bring that up on appeal, whatever they want, but yeah. All I know is the facts of the case is presented, and they tried to deny that he was under the influence of PCP because he was not combative and not out of control.
Didn't they do blood work?
Yeah.
And he was.
Sure he was. Absolutely.
If anything, that would seem like a defense that he was temporarily insane as a result of PCP intoxication. I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm not in that field.
Yeah.
All I know is that I testified that he was under the influence of PCP on the depressant mode when it happened.
If we wanted to get all of the incident report, the police incident report or any of the documentation on that case, is it possible to get that? Because we wanted to include him in our piece.
You can contact the department and find out. I have no way of, I don't believe you, there is, but you can contact the department and ask him.
Because he's, one of these quintessential PCP horror stories. But a lot of these people, when you start to really look into the story carefully, there's some ambiguity, they're not quite as clear-cut. An example of PCP psychosis is the original.
He had her heart under his arm.
He had her heart under his arm.
You know that?
I did not know that.
Her heart was in his armpit.
Wow.
At least that's what I was told.
I had no idea. That's...
Don't know. Like I said, it's just one of those things. But that case is an anomaly. It's few and far between. Very rarely do we see anything of that nature because they control the dose levels here.
Right. I think that's another issue when people talk about drugs in the media, is because the media always emphasizes these extreme negative reactions. So
kind of like they do with law enforcement, right?
Yes, well, it's true. Yes, yeah. It's just the way the news works. So, if you were to learn about drugs exclusively from the way they're covered in the news, you'd think PCP turns people into superhuman cannibals exclusively, that bath salts turns people into cannibals, that all these drugs are just deadly, nightmarish poisons. But of course, they're extremely profitable and people use them and presumably people enjoy them. Do you have any idea what a more typical PCP response is like that isn't represented by one of these extreme cases?
Well, not really, because I don't associate with many people that use PCP. I do have one individual that I've worked with over the years that smokes PCP regularly, and when he does, he usually calls me up crying. But
crying tears of joy,
just tears. He's crying about something, but he gets something in his life, something going on, just crying. It's really emotional. I've never known him to be violent or out of control, and I've never really seen him under the influence, because I'll arrest him, or I would have arrested him. So he calls me up. Like I said, my job as a law enforcement officer was to enforce the state and federal laws, and being under the influence is a violation of 11-550, and had he been under your influence in front of me, I'd have arrested him. But I know that he gets high, and he, for some reason, he calls me up crying.
Hmm. Yeah. So some people cry, some people...
People are different. People do everything differently. It affects people differently. No two people are the same in anything.
Right.
So, can't answer a question like that other than the one fact that I know.
Yeah, I guess the more simple version of the question would be, why do people use it?
I have no idea. I don't drink and I don't smoke. Never have. Never did drugs, because my whole life I wanted to be a cop. I wanted to be a dope cop. So, growing up, in the 70s, I changed my group of friends, 3 times. Because my group of friends started smoking weed and doing doofy, goofy things, so I changed friends. Because I knew what I wanted. But that's me.
Yeah.
I can't talk about anybody else.
Why did you want to be a dope cop?
Don't have a clue. I wanted to become a cop when I was 5 years old. And I wanted to be an undercover dope cop. And I was lucky enough to be able to do that for a long time.
Was your dad a cop?
Nope. Dad's a contractor.
Huh.
Nobody in my family were ever cops. Just something I have no idea, no knowledge, but I, from the time I was 5 years old, I wanted to be a cop, and I wanted to be a dope cop. And I was lucky enough to succeed in both of those fields.
I've seen some literature from the DEA. I have a book that has some a bar graph.
I've seen it.
Then they show that in 1977, PCP was more popular than even methamphetamine in terms of, as gauged by the number of clandestine lab.
Yeah, well, you got to remember, back in the 70s, methamphetamine was a predominantly biker drug, and you could only snort it or inject it. You couldn't smoke it. It was a non-smokable drug. It didn't become smokable until the late 80s, early 90s, when they realized they could crystallize methamphetamine and smoke it. Up until that point, it was injectable. Most of the people injected meth hydro, or peanut butter meth, which is not real pleasing. Or they snorted the crystal fresh off a lab. You couldn't chase the dragon with it. You can't light a flame under, you can't put it out under some tinfoil and light a flame under the tinfoil and inhale the vapors like you can with heroin, because the impurities in hydro meth is that it burns, so you won't get high at all. You'll be inhaling all the contaminants. So back in the 70s and back all the way up through the mid 80s, meth wasn't really as bad as it was. It's like cocaine. Cocaine went crazy in the 80s because they realized they could base it and smoke it. People don't mind smoking. If you can smoke something, people will do it. People will accept smoking. In the 30s, the tobacco industry used to try to advertise to kids for smoking, how smoking is so good for you, right? Everybody smoked.
Yeah.
Now they're getting around that. But smoking is not the taboo that injecting a needle into your body is. A lot of people are afraid to do that. And up until it was smokable, meth wasn't that crazy. That's why cocaine was out of control, because they could smoke cocaine base.
Right.
And the PCP users were all the same PCP users. Guys that were using PCP are the same guys using PCP today. We still have OGs out there that dip sherms. Every day they smoke their sherm all the time, but the guys that are doing it for new, up and coming guys, they do it by the drop. In fact, there's in Skid Row they sell it called by the call it dabs. Got a guy who'll stand in the doorway, you show up with your with a bottle cap off the street. For $10, he'll take a drop of PCP and drop it in the bottle cap for you. Then you walk out, take your cigarette, and dab the cigarette into that one drop as you're walking away. The cops show up, you drop the cigarette, or you drop the bottle cap. 1/20th of a milliliter of PCP, is it going to evaporate, number one? Number two, unless the cop knows what he's looking for or knows what's happening, they'll walk by you. You're not going to get caught.
Right.
And that happens all day long.
Right, but it's a 70s drug, the way most people think of it. They associate it with the 1970s. You know, if you type in, like, PCP in Google image search, you see all these photos from the 70s. Is that a false assumption, that this has somehow decreased in its popularity since the 1970s?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It increased. It's increased. The difference is people don't talk about it, and they half the world doesn't know about it yet. PCP is alive and well. But you ask the average person, they're going to tell you, PCP? I haven't seen that in years. But yeah, this team here is actively working multiple 100-gallon cases all the time. They're cooking multiple 100 gallons of PCP at a time, and it gets shipped by planes, trains, and automobiles every single day out of L.A. So you tell me, is it more now or less?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We have to stop. I have so many questions. I really enjoyed. Do we have to stop now?
Yeah.
We have to stop.